Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, two of the biggest names in comics, Dave Gibbons and Tim Pilcher, discuss their fascinating careers and their book, Confabulation, an Anecdotal Autobiography. As co-creator of Watchmen and with a back catalogue that includes everything from Doctor Who to Batman, Gibbons is comic book royalty. Writer, historian, and comic book expert Pilcher is the chair of the Comic Book Alliance and dubbed the voice of the British comics industry. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this dynamic duo discuss how the industry has changed and how their friendship evolved into collaboration.
Morning, everyone. Lovely to see you all here. My background is I've written about 20 books on the history of comics and current editor of Insight Editions, working on the definitive history of Superman. But the person you've really come here to see is over here. I was going to say multiple Hugo, but you've only won the one Hugo. But multiple Eisner Award-winning creator with a 40-plus year career in comics.
50-plus.
50, oh, there you go. I was being nice.
Thanks, Tim.
Playing it down. You've worked in fanzines, underground comics. You're an artist on 2000 AD, Doctor Who, co-creator of Rogue Trooper, Give Me Liberty with Frank Miller, and, of course, the most successful graphic novel of all time, Watchmen. It is Dave Gibbons.
Thank you.
So, Dave, we're here to talk primarily about your career as a whole, but particularly about this book that you've just written, Confabulation, an Anecdotal Autobiography. So why an autobiography now?
Well, I suppose because I have had a sort of 40, 50-year career in the business. I've sort of done a lot of quite interesting things from a comic book point of view. You know, to work on 2000 AD, which was a groundbreaking comic, was great. And then I was lucky enough to be recruited by DC Comics, which was like a childhood dream come true. And then, of course, I worked on Watchmen, which has become very, very well known and turned into movies and things like that. So I thought, you know, probably if you're a fan of comics, I've had enough interesting experience that you might quite like to read an autobiography. But the thing that was a little bit unusual about what I wanted to do is I didn't want to do it just as a chronological slog through my life. In other words, you have to read page after page of what I did at school and then my early struggles, you know, my revenge upon those who wronged me and all that sort of stuff. So I was inspired by a book that Mike Richardson, the publisher of Dark Horse Comics, had done called Comics Between the Panels, where it was an alphabetical kind of encyclopedia of comics. So I thought, I know, I'll do an alphabetical encyclopedia of me and feature myself, obviously, because I'm the subject of the autobiography, but to talk about my friendship with other people in the field and the different things that I'd worked on. And I found it quite an easy thing to write because I viewed it as if I was chatting to you down the pub, you know, like you'd reminded me of a story. And I'd sort of tell the story. And I wrote it, I'd just get up in the morning and think, what do I want to write about today? And I'd look at my list of headings or people or comics and think, I know, yeah, I'll write about Alan Moore today. I know, I'll write about Zaga, Man of Mystery. And so it just sort of accumulated. And reasonably early on in that, I spoke to Tim about it because Tim has got a varied background as an editor. And he was very helpful in helping me decide what should go in the book and what shouldn't. What were the best examples of my work? What were the most interesting stories? And between us and many Zoom calls, we knocked it into shape. And I really, really enjoyed doing it. And it has been well received in the world of comics. And it just felt like I had a story to tell, which is what I've done all my life. And this time it's the story of me.
So, I mean, let's talk a little about your 50-plus year career. I mean, I was saying it's 50-plus years, but you've been drawing sort of superheroes all your life, really. I mean, if we go to here, which is one of the earliest ones.
Well, that was the date's a bit cut off, but it was Boxing Day. No, the day after Boxing Day in 1957, when I was 8 years old, and clearly I got a Superman annual for Christmas, and I copied this picture out. And actually, considering my age, it's not that bad, actually. Not quite up to professional standards. And I was always attracted towards Superman because when I was growing up, he was the only superhero. Him and Batman really were the only superheroes around. And I spent a lot of time copying pictures of Superman. And I used to have a wonderful device called a pantograph, which you could enlarge drawings with. It was like an armature, and it had a pointer, and you'd move the pointer around the outlines of what you wanted to copy, and a pencil in an extreme distance from it would duplicate the line, but bigger. So I could copy Superman and make him as big as a door, which kind of foreshadows the way comics are done anyway, although I didn't know it at the time. So it was always Superman, it was always drawing. And this is just a picture of Superman, but I also used to make up my own stories. I never, in my own head, divided the stories from the art. So from an early age, I was practicing drawing splash pages, continuity pages. So it was always comics.
Yeah. And then, of course, as your career developed, you actually ended up drawing Superman professionally.
Yeah. I mean, DC. If 8-year-old Dave could have seen that, I'd have just been boggled, you know, because it's published by DC Comics. It really is Superman. And it was edited by a guy called Julius Schwartz, who edited all my favorite comics growing up, Flash, Green Lantern, Justice League, Hawkman, The Atom. And he was the editor on the book. And of course, Alan Moore wrote it, so you know it's going to be a good script. And that was one of those real, it was like scoring a goal at Wembley or something like that. You know, it's wow, I did it. So yeah, that was great.
That moment. But between there and here, there is a bit of a journey. So we'll kind of look at that. I mean, you worked a lot. I mean, it's an interesting thing that often I think people imagine you just kind of draw comics and suddenly you've got a career. But you actually sort of paid your dues all the way through, starting out and doing fanzines and things like this advert for Dark They Were and Golden Eyed. Perhaps you'd like to talk a bit about that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's all very well to sort of draw things on sheets of wallpaper or in your maths rough book or something like that. But that's not, you haven't been published. It just feels like a little hobby that you do on your own. And it's a huge thrill, as anybody here will know if they've ever had their work published. It's a huge thrill because it's now a real thing in the world. It's concrete. You can give it to people. People can give you feedback on it. So I was, in the early stages of my career, I was happy to draw anything. So I did a lot for fanzines, which of course pay nothing, but they get your work seen. And when you go to a comic show, people go, oh, you're Dave Gibbons. You did the ad on the back of Fantasy Advertiser number 27 or something obscure. But you're actually kind of in the business. You're connecting to other people. And the thing that really got me into professional comics was doing lettering, balloon lettering, because my dad had an architectural background and he drew plans at home in the evening. And I would help him by doing the letter. He showed me how to do neat lettering. So I was able to do that when I was in my early teens. So the first approaches that I made to professional comics was doing balloon lettering on other people's artwork, which again got my face known. And at least if I wasn't particularly good at drawing, it proved that I was reliable and I was reasonably pleasant to deal with, you know. So, and then underground comics came along, which paid a little, not very much. It was still really doing it for the love of it. But again, even on a different scale, that was getting stuff into the wider world. And so I'd probably been working in comics as a fan and an underground contributor for maybe 4 or 5 years before I got proper mainstream publishing artwork credits. And that was really my training ground. I came across some old drawing pads that I had, and it's page after page of human anatomy and machines and faces and expressions. And so they will say it only took me 5 years to become an overnight success. So
in an interesting way, it's almost like doing an apprenticeship, but very publicly. So, you know, you're making your mistakes and you're learning in a public arena.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the early work I did was for DC Thompson, you know, who are based in Dundee. They published The Beano and The Dandy. And they never give artists or writers credits. Very few people who I know ever read sort of comics like The Wizard or The Hotspur. So you were sort of learning with nobody looking particularly, and your name wasn't associated with it. But that was another part of my training, because they're quite, in some ways, quite an old-fashioned outfit at DC Thompson. But they were really my training ground, because my agent got me the work, a guy called Barry Coker, who was in London. But he got me work in Dundee that I never would have got short of actually going to Dundee. And I would draw the episode out in pencil, give it to Barry. He'd then send it to DC Thompson. and they would write comments on it as to what was wrong with it or what I could improve upon. And I'd get those pencils back and make the changes and then ink them in. So it was a wonderful nuts and bolts way of learning how to do comics. And you're challenged to draw things which aren't just superheroes or spaceships, which I would naturally gravitate towards. So it sort of takes you out of your comfort zone. To the point that Alan Moore once said to me, he said, "It's great working with you, Dave, because I know you can draw anything I ask you to draw." So, yeah, that was really my grounding in it.
Well, that leads quite nicely onto the next thing. You've done work which isn't just comics, but is kind of comics related. There's a piece of your fanzine work. I think that's probably your most reprinted fanzine strip.
Yeah, that appeared in International Times, which was an underground magazine. It appeared in YAM, Youth Action Magazine, right on. And also, I think, in Starburst. I think Des Skin ran it in Starburst. I've never, ever been paid a penny for it, but it was an early calling card of mine where people said, "Oh, I thought this was drawn by an American. Wow, could you do this work for us?" So that was, yeah, it was my calling card, really.
But then you've gone on and done sort of comics related, but yeah, slightly off on a kilter as well. You've done a lot of commercial work as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to draw anything. It didn't have to be superheroes. And I got a call one day from this guy who was putting together some cover artwork for Jethro Tull's Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die. Never been a Jethro Tull fan. And he said, "You know, I've made a start on it, but I need somebody to come and help me finish it. You know, would you be interested?" And I thought, yeah, that wouldn't be bad. So I went along to see him, and he had this huge bit of artboard, blank, apart from that picture at the top left-hand corner. So that was his idea of making a start, and the rest of it was me finishing it off. But I did get quite well paid for it, because comics as publications don't pay very well, but because this was for a record company, there was a bit more money in it, to the degree that a friend of mine that I was speaking to about it down the pub was a reporter for the local newspaper. And he said, "Dave, we ought to run a story on that local boy who makes good." So they sent a reporter around and took pictures of me at my drawing board. You know, "Dave rock and rolls," and, you know, like "local boy makes good." And the great thing about that was it was seen by an artist called Mick McMahon, who you probably know, wonderful Judge Dredd artist. And it turned out he lived just, you know, a mile or two away from me. He wrote me a very polite letter. "Dear Mr. Gibbons, you know, as a revered comic artist," I got to know Mick a bit better later, and that was the only reverence I've ever had from him, that first letter. But so that was good. That was a foot in another camp. So, yeah.
But didn't you have an issue with sort of the deadlines and their concerns?
Oh, yeah. So anyway, I'm at home. I still live with my mum and dad in those days. And the phone rang, and this guy goes, "Is this Dave Gibbons?" So I said, yeah, he went, "Right, this is whatever his name was. I'm the manager of Jethro Tull. Are you doing some cover artwork for us?" I went, "Yeah, I've nearly finished." He said, "We haven't seen it, and we're worried that it even exists. We want to see it tonight." I said, "Okay, yeah, well, you can come around if you like." So I gave him my address, which was right off in the wilds of Hertfordshire. And I went to where my mum and dad were watching telly in the front room. I said, "There's going to be a knock on the door in a little while. I'll get it. It's going to be a rock star." So I went to the front door when it was knocked, and there was standing Ian Anderson, you know, the Jethro Tull guy, foot up playing a flute, and his very cross-looking manager. And I led them through into the dining room, where I had the piece of artwork on the table with a black flap. If there's any aspiring artist here, even if you've done a really crappy bit of artwork, put like a black flap on it, and then it looks like you really care about these things. So, and in those days I used to smoke. I don't recommend it. If you do smoke, please give it up. But I remember that I threw back the flap and lit my cigarette and light. So I took one huge drag on it, and they looked at it, total silence. And then Ian Anderson goes, "Yeah, I like it. Well done, Dave." And it was all friends and back slapping and handshakes. So it all turned out really well. Never saw them again. Nobody ever spoke to me about it. They did a special edition of it lately where they did finally interview me and give me good credit for it. But they liked it so much, obviously, at Chrysalis Records, that this was actually the center spread in Melody Maker. So they must have paid quite a lot to advertise in that space. So, yeah, it went very well. And I was able to put the money as a down payment on a house. So it worked out really well.
Brilliant. But it's not the only time that you've done sort of stuff for bands and music, because there's that album cover, which bizarrely, I always loved, but for some reason, it was only years later I discovered that that was you.
All right. Well, the story on that was our mutual friend, Ryan Hughes, who's a wonderful typographer. He shared a studio with the, I forget the guy's name now, but who did a lot of stuff for artwork for record companies. He said to Ryan, he said, oh, you're in the comics business. He said, do you know anybody who sort of draws like Dave Gibbons? Ryan said, well, I actually know Dave Gibbons. I said, oh, we'll have him. And they phoned me up and said they really liked what I'd done on Watchmen. And they described me what they wanted the cover to be. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. So it was basically a question of coming up with as many characters as you could think of whose names began with K. Like you got Martin Luther King and Lord Kitchener and Karl Marx and Grace Kelly and Ken Dodd and King Kong, John F. Kennedy. And the guy who was effectively Cooler Shaker, Crispian Mills, would phone me up and go, oh, Dave, I've thought of another one. And I actually had to say to him at one point on the third of these calls, I'm afraid the boat has left the harbour now. There's no room for anybody left on board, Crispian. And I got quite well paid for that as well. But I also phoned him up one night and a very nice lady answered the phone and I realised, it's Hayley Mills. It's actually Hayley Mills from the Disney film. So that was quite a nice little brush with fame. And yeah, and it was also one of the first things I did on the computer. So all the drawing was done by hand, but all the colour is digital. And it, of course, the computer made it much easier to assemble the artwork on that. So that was quite a significant turn.
So you've done so much in your career. We're obviously not going to be able to cover everything in the time that we have here. But one of the things you did do is you had like one of the longest runs, I think, drawing Doctor Who. I don't think there's anyone that's drawn it longer than
I drew it for probably about 50 issues, something like that.
Yeah.
A couple of years probably. Because it was Doctor Who Weekly and then it became Doctor Who Monthly. But it's still going, isn't it? Which is great. And Tom Baker was my doctor. Really easy to draw with it, you know, big nose, big double chin, curly hair, big cheesy grin all the time. And a shouty, you know, quite an extravagant way of acting. So it was quite easy to get his likeness. But then Peter Davison took over. And all of a sudden I was in trouble because, well, in fact, to fast forward, the relaunch of Doctor Who earlier in the year or late last year was an adaptation of a story that I'd done with Pat Mills called The Star Beast, with a character called the Meep, who's this kind of intergalactic villain. And they wanted to base an episode on it and invited me and Pat Mills to the set to see it being filmed, which was brilliant because there was the Meep, there were the Roth Warriors, you know, and it was just, and they built a spaceship, it was just fantastic. So I said to David Tennant, because David Tennant said to me on the set, so you used to draw Tom Baker, didn't you? He was your doctor. I said, yeah. But then he left and Peter Davison took over. And although Tom Baker was easy to draw, Peter Davison was a bit like trying to draw a blancmange because he was like very pale, hardly had any eyebrows, had blonde hair. Was sort of quite an averagely good looking sort of guy. There was nothing to get hold of. He said, oh, it's like drawing a blancmange, was it? So I said, yeah. He said, you do know that Peter Davison is my son-in-law.
Your father-in-law.
It's a great story if you tell it right. Yeah. Peter Davison is my father-in-law. And I said, well, he was a blancmange, but he was a very good-looking blancmange. And in fact, he was really good, Peter Davison. He let us go to the BBC studios where he was filming an episode. And we got loads of reference shots, you know, his face from different angles, putting different expressions. And actually, I got, I think, a better likeness of him in the end than I had done of Tom Baker. Yeah, great, yeah.
So, but you're known primarily as an artist, but you've actually written a lot throughout your career. I mean, you've done sort of a World's Finest, you've written Superman, Batman versus Predator, your own graphic novel, The Originals, which won an Eisner. And so for you, I mean, do you enjoy writing as much as drawing? Or, I mean, how do you sort of approach those two different sort of,
well,
aspects?
You know, growing up, I wasn't aware that there was a separate writer and an artist. I thought one person did the whole thing, you know, and lettered the balloons and did that. So I was always interested in telling stories. And that's what I'm really interested in when I draw a picture, is how well it tells the story. You know, there's a test of, you can ask of any picture in a comic book, is what is this picture showing in story terms? Is it character? Is it mood? Is it important information? And so I've always approached comics in that way, as a storytelling artist rather than just an illustrator who happens to draw comics, because it is a different discipline. It is a different skill. So I was given the chance to write that Superman Batman story by an editor called Mike Carlin up at DC, and talk about starting at the top. You know, it was drawing their two Kingpin characters, and that seemed to go down very well, and I found it quite easy to do. And a lot of drawing is craft, you know, it's drawing a particular line or getting the composition or the perspective or the anatomy right. Whereas with words, if you've got the right word or the right set of words, you're done. It's more modular. It's not to dismiss writing as being less of less value, but it's a completely different discipline. And I found that I actually liked doing that as a change of pace. But the thing that was difficult about doing the originals, which was a bit of an autobiographical thing, sort of science fiction mods, if you like, was that I was writing during the whole thing. And I discovered that the other thing I really liked about comics was the collaboration, because they take a long time to do. And if it's just you sat in a room, as it was for me with the originals, you think, does anybody care about this? Am I just sitting in a room going slightly mad? You know, is there still an outside world? So I got my editor up at DC to phone me every Friday and ask me for a number. So it would have to be a number at least four higher than I told him the previous Friday, because I knew I had to do four pages a week. And it was the discipline of doing that that actually got me through it. And it was quite, I found it quite difficult, because there's nobody to bounce ideas off of. There's nobody to try ideas out on. So I think, much though I enjoyed writing and drawing, it's really one or the other for me. And I've done shorter stories where I've written and drawn them. But when you're doing anything of any length, God, it just helps. It is much better to be part of a team than a solo flyer.
Yeah. I mean, you've written things like The Green Lantern as well, and lots of different things. But it's interesting that people seem to always equate you as an artist, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've done much, much more drawing than I have writing.
Yeah.
But no, I'm really pleased with that. I have managed to get out there, and people have been quite trusting. As I say, in the beginning, I was an untried writer. And quite often, artists don't make the best writers, because they're only thinking of the visual end of it. But as I say, I think I fall in, if there was a Venn diagram which has got artists and writers, I think I'm in the bit where it overlaps. Somewhere in there, probably nearer to artists, whereas someone like Alan Moore, for instance, or Pat Mills, they're very visual writers. So they're also in that Venn diagram, in the bit that overlaps in the middle. And then you get artists who are just love the drawing, and the story suffers, or writers who just love purple prose, and the story suffers. So to me, I just want to be in that bit in the middle with a staunch collaborator by my side.
Yeah, that's good. So in the book, I mean, you were talking about starting out doing lettering, and you talk about the infamous font Comic Sans. Can you explain a little bit about your relationship with Comic Sans?
Yeah, well, when I saw Comic Sans, I thought it sort of looked like my lettering, or rather generic comic book lettering. And I just dismissed it as being coincidence, but I actually got to know the guy who online, the guy who created Comic Sans. He's a guy called Vincent Canaire, who turns out to be a really, really nice guy. And he was working for a company that was producing fonts for Microsoft. And one morning they said, we need a comic book font. We want something that's, you know, bright and breezy and bouncy, but we need it by 5 o'clock tonight. So he had one day to put a whole font together. But being, as I say, a nice guy and a man of great taste and discernment, on his bookshelf he had Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns. So he got them down off the shelf and used some of the letter forms that I'd done, some of the letter forms that John Costanza, who lettered Dark Knight Returns, had done, and did like a kind of a smushed kind of version of them. And it is a horrible typeface, and he would agree that it's a horrible typeface. But there was nothing he could do. It was needed that day. So now you see it all over the place. I mean, and like, it's fair enough if it's for a school fete or a car boot sale. But, you know, people have seen them for solicitors, funeral directors, hairdressers, you know. So that's my legacy to the world. And you keep seeing it. It keeps popping up everywhere. But I don't know why he didn't just use my font or John Costanza's font. But as I say, he's a nice guy, true professional, doing a job. And there it is.
Yeah. He's probably realised that he would have to pay you something if he just ripped your font off.
Well, I'm sort of thinking, you know, should we be paid anyways? But no, I don't think so. I think I'll make it my gift to the world.
So within the book, you obviously talk about the thing that you're probably most well associated with, which is Watchmen. This is a cover you did for Mad, isn't it? Sort of like your own sort of parody. Within Watchmen, I mean, you know, we're fast approaching. It's the 40th anniversary in 2 years.
Sure, just, it is.
Yeah. just feels like that it. In. Yeah. And, you know, they did a motion comic back in 2008. There was the Zack Snyder directed film in 2009. There was the TV series sequel in 2019. And they've just released a trailer for a new 2-part animated film that's coming out in August, I think it is. So what do you think it is that keeps people watching The Watchmen? Why do people keep coming back to that?
Well, I think because it's a limited thing. It's not like doing animated series or movies about Batman or Superman. You know, the story of Watchmen is really that one story, which is why I wasn't so keen on the prequels, because that's a bit like explaining a joke or something. You know, it starts where Alan and I started, and in a sense, Watchmen ends where we ended. I was dubious about the TV thing to begin with, but I had a long discussion with Damon Lindelof, who was the showrunner on it, and he so got it and had such a novel idea that I thought, you know, I'd like to see that. And I think the masterstroke of what he did was to set it in the present day with the events of Watchmen having happened in the 80s, and that took it so far away from it that rather than being a specific sequel, it was more of a diversion or a sort of a... What's the word I'm searching for? An extrapolation of threads in Watchmen with bits added to it that we didn't do. Some stuff, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but there was some stuff that I looked at and I thought, why didn't we think of that? That's such a good solution. And of course, they did keep the original ending, which the movie famously didn't, although I was okay with that because it would have taken such a huge chunk out of the movie. It was already a big movie to explain away the fifth dimensional squid. But as far as the animated thing is concerned, which I have been a little bit involved with, it works really, really well because there's something about live action which is just, it hasn't got the human hand on it in a way, if you know what I mean. What I think made Watchmen so interesting as a graphic novel was it looks like an ordinary comic book and it looks very conventional, but it's only when you start to read it you realise it's not, that it's going into areas that comics haven't traditionally gone into. There's full frontal male nudity, which got through without anybody objecting at all. So there's a surprise in there. And I think that works well in the animated version as well, where you associate animation with kids and juvenile stuff. But this isn't. And technically speaking, I'm so pleased with the way it looks because when I drew Watchmen, I inked it with what we call a kind of a clear line, not a heavily accentuated brush line, but quite a hard pen line. And of course, the way they do computer-generated but hand-drawn looking animation is to set up a special rendering algorithm which converts three-dimensional objects into outline drawings. And it looks, you've seen the trailer, some of you have probably seen the trailer, it looks to me like I drew it, that it's completely in my style. And they've used all the layouts that I did, all the compositions. I haven't heard it with any dialogue on it, so I don't know how well what Alan did translates to it. But I'm really looking forward to it being out. I really think they've done it.
So have you seen like the whole thing without sound?
No, I've seen the trailers and I've seen a sort of show reel that they did where you go from the sketch, you know, the page in the comic to their sketch of it, to the three-dimensional rendered model, to the outline rendered model, to the thing with all the lights and effects, and a soundtrack rather than dialogue. But it looks really, really good. And compared to the motion comic, which was there was a lot of effort and care put into that, but it looks primitive. You know, it's, to be honest, slightly embarrassing. And also because it had a single voice artist working on it. And you get to the point where there's Laurie in bed with two Dr. Manhattan and another Dr. Manhattan, and the voices are all supplied by the same guy. And I remember thinking it must have been a bit of a hot and steamy day in the sound booth when they recorded that. So there are all sorts of shortcomings, but it did show that it kind of could be done. Whether it should have been done is another issue. But no, I'm very happy with the animation. And I hope that the fans will, it'll be the same effect as with the HBO TV series, that a lot of fans will be prepared not to like it, but probably the excellence of it will change their mind.
So that all we have to wait for is Watch Babies now to come out.
Well, of course, that's what you're fighting against, Watch Babies, yeah, which was the Simpsons parody, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I am aware of that, and I think all the people who are working on the animation are well aware of that, so every step has been taken not to go into those areas.
Yeah. So recently, not only have you been writing Confabulation, or have written Confabulation, but you've done an audio book of it as well. Is that's the first time you've ever done an audio book?
Yeah, it was great. I got picked up every day and taken to somebody's back garden in Chelmsford and locked in a cupboard and told to read my book. So, you know, my wife thought it was good because it got me out of the house, but it got me out of the house into somebody's garden shed, so it wasn't that much of an experience. But it was a really interesting thing to do because I had written the autobiography sort of in my voice, and people who have read it before the audiobook said they can imagine me saying it's the turns of phrase that I use and the way I speak. And when we came to record the sound, there were two things that they kept saying to me. One was, more energy, Dave, more energy, because it was a story that maybe wasn't one of my favourite ones, and I was sort of going through it a little bit like that. On the other hand, when I came to one of my favourite stories, I'd be talking really quickly, really animatedly. So technically speaking, there was the thing of actually making it more consistent. And I got good direction from Helen Quigley and Andrew Saul of B7
Media,
who I think they're on the flyer. You can pick up the flyer. And I think they're actually putting the audiobook version up online.
Yeah.
I think it might actually be up there already.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to hear me read my own words, and you know, it's better than listening to the radio these days, let's face it. So, yeah, but it was a really interesting experience to do. And, yeah, and I also included some bonus anecdotes. I think it even says now with bonus anecdotes. And because the minute I'd finished doing the autobiography, it was, oh, shit, I didn't put in that story about the New York taxi driver. That's one of the best ones. So it gave me the chance to put some PSs on there. So you'll find stuff that you haven't already read.
But it's also nice to kind of almost like listen along and read and listen at the same time.
Yeah, of course, we do lack the pictures. But yeah, if you've got the book open in front of you, you can get the experience of looking at the artwork as well.
Yeah, and you can kind of talk that through at the same time.
So I suggest you buy both, basically.
Well, we've still got a little bit of extra time. We've got time to look at a few extra bits and pieces from the book. And one of the things that, you know, I think people often bring up was the fact that not only have you drawn superheroes, but actually you were a superhero.
In
your younger days.
I needed the money, what can I say?
Can you tell us a little bit about how you became Big E? In Tornado?
Well, Tornado was originally designed as a companion comic to 2000 AD with much the same editorial staff and the same contributors. And in 2000 AD, from the very first issue, they had as the pretend editor of the comic, Tharg from Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice. And he would introduce the issue on the second page and address the Earthlets and tell them what they ought to be reading. And, you know, it was sort of a bit satirical and a bit funny. So when they decided to come up with a companion comic, they thought they would call it Heroes, which I thought that's a pretty good title. And it would have a space hero and a cowboy hero, like a usual anthology thing, but all done with a sort of 2000 AD edge. And then they thought, oh, we ought to really have the equivalent of Tharg introducing everything. So they thought, we need a superhero. That's what we should have. They originally asked John Wagner, who's quite a tall, imposing figure, and not quite as good looking as me, but, you know, quite heroic looking in his day. And he wanted far too much money to do it. But they said to me, hey, Dave, do you want to do this for 50 quid or something? I went, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do it. It'd be great. So we went to a theatrical costumers and got some bits and pieces. And I did this chest emblem because the character was going to be called Big E for editor. So he was jokingly referred to as Big Ed. Seemed funny at the time. Anyway, they got me to dress up, and we spent a day at Kingsreach Tower, which was where IPC magazines were published. We got up on the roof. The one thing I did discover was that when you're standing on the top of a tall building, cape equals sail. You don't want to stand too close to the edge of the building because the wind actually takes it. And in the confabulation, the autobiography, there's some pictures that didn't appear in print that were done for the Staff magazine of me looking absolutely terrified, clinging onto a fire escape. So, but it was a real good fun to do. People come up to me at conventions as if it's some guilty secret and go, remember this day? And yeah, I do remember it. And I'm perfectly at peace with my inner superhero. There was a little bit of touching. Does that sound right? A little bit of photographic touching up, I suppose I should say, where they took my pod out of it and they took my double chin out as well with the careful application of a brush. But yeah, and this is Nick Lander, who later went on to own Forbidden Planet and Titan Books, and Steve McManus, who actually was Tharg at the time, and me. And Kevin O'Neill was the office boy, the equivalent of Jimmy Olsen, and the various typists who became the women who were in danger that I had to rescue from harm's way. So it was a good fun day, and I did get paid for it. It was a lot easier than sitting down drawing for a day.
So you've worked with a lot of interesting people, like Frank Miller and Mark Miller there.
Mm, no relation.
Mm. Yeah, slightly different spellings. And Alan Moore, of course. So you've managed to work with some of the biggest writers in the industry.
Yeah, I've been really lucky, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, having a lot of stuff adapted for the screen. So like Watchmen.
Kingsman.
And Kingsman.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, it was never in my game plan, and I've never sort of approached my career with any sort of planning at all. It's just if somebody asked me to do something, I think, yeah, I'd like to do that. Or no, I wouldn't like to do that. And I think I learned a long time ago never to do anything just for the money, because it's always, I pay you more like in advertising. I remember one morning, about 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, I had a guy from an ad agency came to pick up a bit of artwork, and he was looking over my shoulder at the drawing board and going, make that car more shiny, it's got to be more shiny. And I thought, no, yeah, this.
That piece, yeah.
I thought, no amount of money's really worth this, you know. Because you're either thinking to yourself, well, at least I'm getting well paid for it, or I'm not even getting well paid for it. So I tend to I get that gut feeling. And as it turns out, a lot of the people I've worked with have been people whose work I would love to read anyway. So it's been a great privilege. And I think it also puts you on your best game, because people like Alan Moore and Frank Miller and Mark Miller put so much into their work that you feel you mustn't let them down, you know, so it makes you go that bit further to get it right.
Yes. Do we have any questions in the audience? Does anyone like to ask Dave any questions? Yeah, just at the back there.
Have you ever worked for Marvel?
Have you ever worked with Marvel?
Yeah, I haven't done much for Marvel. It's weird. I always preferred DC comics when I was growing up. They just sort of looked more attractive to me. They looked brighter and more interesting. And I sort of have become part of the family at DC, because so much of my work for the past probably 30 years now has been for DC in one way or another. And I've done odd things for Marvel, because obviously the business is actually quite small. And I know loads of writers and artists and editors who work for Marvel. But I've only ever done shorter things. I did a Doctor Strange story. I did a Captain America story that I wrote. Yeah, that's the Doctor Strange. That's a digital recreation, that one. But it's just, I'm so ensconced in the DC world that I've never really had to look elsewhere. And really, it's the two characters that I really love are Doctor Strange, because there's no real equivalent of him in DC, and Captain America, who is, again, one of the top pantheon, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, you know, they're in that top tier. And I don't think I probably will work for them now, but it's not because I have any reason not to.
Any other questions?
That's your only chance.
Yeah, just at the front here.
Hi, I'm a big 2000 AD fan, so I know you from Problem One, Alan Heroes and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then Dan Dare and so on. So I just wondered why you never did anything else after sort of Rogue Trooper, was it? And you never came back anything?
The real reason was that DC Comics came over to England specifically to recruit British artists and writers.
Yeah.
And because I'd always loved DC Comics as a kid, it was something I was going to say yes to anyway. But when they told us the terms, which was basically the page rate was going to be about twice what we were getting in England, they'd give us royalties if it became a book. They'd pay a usage fee if they used the artwork again. They gave you the paper to draw on. It was, you know, there was no way you could say no to it. And they gave me enough work that I didn't have to look elsewhere. And so I sort of walked away from 2000 AD. But again, I've always had a good relationship with them. And from time to time, I've done an odd cover or a shorter story. And I'm really thrilled that what we did, and particularly what Pat Mills and John Wagner did in the early days, mean that it's still going. I mean, it's amazing. I had to miss it this year, but the Lawless Con, there's all the creators who are sort of in their 60s and 70s and all the fans who have read it since day one in their 50s and so. And it's a real phenomenon in British comic publishing that it's kept its audience and a lot of its contributors for so long. So congratulations.
You don't fancy doing a one-off or anything? You wouldn't do a want a strip?
Not now. Because I've done so much drawing to deadline that I'm not really interested in deadlines or going back to something that I'd already done. I'd rather try and do new stuff. But I always feel part of that family as well, and they've always treated me very well. They send me a free copy of the prog every week, so I keep up with what's going on. But I think it's unlikely that I'd work for them again.
Of course, and there's the Rogue Trooper animated film that's in development.
Yeah, you may know that Duncan Jones, you know, David Bowie's son, who did Moon and
Time Code, I think.
Yeah, there's a weird time travel thing, wasn't there? Yeah. But he's making a film of it, and they were filming it at Rebellion Studios down near Oxford, and we went along to the set, and they're really using real state-of-the-art equipment. They're doing face capture, motion capture, and I've seen some little bits of footage, and it seems really, really true to the comic book, so I've got high hopes for that. And indeed, that's always been a mystery to me, why the publishers haven't been more proactive in getting their characters out there, because they've got a great stable of characters. Obviously, Dredd is the only one to have escaped so far. In a couple of movies which weren't all bad, and the second one in particular I thought was great. And there's been talk of a Dredd TV series, but hopefully if Rogue Trooper does well, you'll see more 2000 AD characters.
You've got a question down here at the front.
I was just wondering about how you still do your artwork. Is it fully digital now, or do you still do it the traditional pen and paper way?
Well, what artwork I do, and as I say, I don't really do very much these days. I do a bit of life drawing, which I really enjoy, and that's just in pencil and, you know, not for reproduction. But I've worked a lot digitally, and it's a really good tool for certain aspects of it. I think it can be a little bit of a distraction sometimes, but I find it useful for doing roughs and for doing preliminary sketches where you can change a layout, like I was saying about the cooler shaker, where you can move things around, rescale it. I find it very useful for doing that. And then at the other end, once you've drawn it, to colour it and to letter it as well. But the bit in the middle, I still prefer drawing by hand. That's what I've discovered over the years, because there is more of a direct contact with it. It's a bit like we went to see ABBA Voyage in their specially built studio. And of course, it's all digital, but they had a live band playing the music, and that somehow revivified it, stopped it from being cold and sterile. And I think that's what can happen with the computer. It becomes almost too perfect, and you lose the idea of an artist drawing it. So, it's a very useful tool, and I've used it a lot. But I don't think it'll ever replace drawing it by traditional methods.
Any other questions?
Yeah, man.
Okay. Well, because I think we're running a little bit late. We'll probably wrap it up there. But Dave will be signing outside after this. So there's books for sale, but also if you've brought anything else, I think you'll be happy to sign as well.
Sure, yeah.
So that's it. So I'd just like to say to Dave Gibbons, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.